Good afternoon. Welcome to the National Press Club. My name is Gil Klein. I'm the club's president and a national correspondent with Media General Newspapers, writing for the Richmond Times-Dispatch, the Tampa Tribune, and the Winston-Salem Journal. I'd like to welcome my fellow club members in the audience today, as well as those of you who are watching us on C-SPAN or listening to us on National Public Radio or the Internet Global Computer Network. Before introducing our head table, I would like to remind our members of some upcoming speakers. Tomorrow, we have Mac McLarty, who we invited as the White House Chief of Staff, and will be speaking to us as the White House Counsel. On Thursday, June 30th, we have actor and author Kirk Douglas, who will talk about the narrowing gap between fact and fiction in both the movies and the news media in a speech entitled Make Believe Versus Reality. And on Tuesday, July 12th, Timothy Wirth, the Undersecretary of State for Global Affairs, will help us present the National Press Club Robert L. Kozik Environmental Reporting Awards. I'd also like to mention that we have a book and author wrap coming up tomorrow, or actually this evening. Author Christopher Buckley will be at the club to discuss his new book entitled Thank You for Smoking. Audio and videotapes of Press Club luncheons are available by calling 1-800-500-9911. If you have any questions for our speaker, and I trust that you will, please write them on the cards provided for you at the tables and pass them forward, and I will ask as many as time permits. I'd like now to introduce our head table guests and ask them to stand briefly when their names are called. From your right, it's Stephen Greenhouse, the State Department correspondent for the New York Times. Betsy Stewart, State Department producer for NBC News. Ken DeLecky, editor of Kiplinger's Florida Business Letter. Marcia Stepanek, correspondent for Hearst Newspapers. Andy Mosher, assistant foreign editor of the Washington Post. Hervé Denis, Minister of Information for the Republic of Haiti. Skipping over our speaker for a moment, we have Mary Crowley, Executive Editor of Business Publishers Incorporated and Vice Chairwoman of the National Press Club Speakers Committee. Ambassador Jean Casimir, Ambassador of the Republic of Haiti. David Anderson of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development and the member of the club Speakers Committee who organized today's luncheon. Patrick McGrath, Capitol Hill correspondent for Fox Television. Larry Littman, correspondent for the Miami Beach Post and a member of the club's Board of Governors. What did I say? Palm Beach Post. What did I say? Washington? Miami. Oh, jeez. Larry Littman, correspondent with the Palm Beach Post, which is just up the road from Miami. And Chris Marquis, the diplomatic correspondent for the Miami Herald. And Todd Lassa, assistant managing editor of the Economic Opportunity Report. You can now applaud. Also, I'd like to thank staff members Melissa Bender, Sherry Burton, Melanie Abdow-Dermott, and Jeff Tarbell for organizing today's luncheon. Now, 2 years and 3 months ago, our speaker, President Jean-Bertrand Aristide of Haiti, spoke at our podium about the possibilities for his imminent return to power. Yet here he is, standing before us still as the exiled leader, the first popularly elected president of Haiti. And his return still appears to be imminent, or maybe not. The story is as fresh as this morning's paper. The Washington Post reported that the Coast Guard is surprised by the huge number of Haitians who are again gambling their lives on rickety boats to seek a chance to plead for political asylum in the United States. I don't know why the Coast Guard is surprised. Every indication pointed to such a development once President Clinton changed U.S. policy to allow refugees entry. Critics of the Clinton administration charge that the president is leading the nation toward an inevitable armed intervention in Haiti to restore Aristide to power. And there isn't a lot of popular support for that. What has changed in the past 2 years is that our speaker has become the focal point of the debate. Even though he was elected in certifiably fair and free elections with 67% of the vote, there are those in the United States who contend that he is not personally committed to democracy. Former President Bush, who had supported Aristide during his administration, made a rare public announcement recently that he no longer thought returning Aristide to power should be the central part of American policy toward Haiti. President Aristide has been criticized for not being willing to compromise to broaden his base of support within Haiti to allow for a peaceful return. Mr. Aristide was a radical priest who risked his life to denounce Haiti's corrupt regime from the pulpit of the Cathedral of Port-au-Prince. He drew his power from the masses of poverty-stricken Haitians angered at the wealth and power of the elite. He contends that he has been the target of character assassination. The Clinton administration has renewed its support for Aristide, changed its policy towards Haitian refugees, and tightened the economic embargo on the country. With refugees again streaming out of Haiti, some kind of showdown is inevitable. Here to give us his perspective of what is happening, please join me in a warm press club welcome for President Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
Mr. President, distinguished members of the National Press Club, distinguished guests, dear friends, it's a pleasure for me to be here with you, and on behalf of the Haitian people, I thank you for giving me this opportunity to be here again with you. 22,300 miles above the Earth's equator, a communication satellite orbits the globe. This satellite follows the Earth's rotation on its axis, circling the planet over a 24-hour period. To any observer, it is immobile as it provides worldwide link-up of radio and television transmissions from locations across the globe. The launching of the first satellite in 1957, contributed in transforming this century into the century of global communication. With these invisible eyes in space, the satellites, and the visible eyes of the media on Earth, your cameras, pen, and computers, the world is moving towards greater knowledge of itself. Information has become the fundamental element of modern life. Journalists are like satellites. You receive information, then convert it into words or images for broadcasting. Images of Rwanda, Somalia, and Bosnia fill the television screens and let us know of the horrors occurring across the world. Since the coup d'etat of September 1991, but more particularly for the past 3 months, Haiti has been the subject of many of those transmissions. In April, over 151 articles on Haiti appeared in major American newspapers. In May, the number surpassed 340. And for the month of June, it has already reached 195. Some journalists are not visible, as for instance, your colleagues in Haiti. They operate underground and from there risk their lives to report on the nation's heroic resistance to 33 months of repression and violence. We should take this moment to salute them and all journalists who work with them in this important endeavor. The media, the press, and you, the journalists, can play an historic role in helping Haiti raise the collective consciousness of the world on the challenges that we face, the struggle for dignity, for peace, for justice. In fact, Haiti has a long history of raising the collective consciousness of the international community. In 1779, over 1,000 Haitian soldiers sailed from Haiti to fight with Americans against British forces in the Battle of Savannah. How peculiar! 18th century Haitians, themselves enslaved, fighting for the independence of the United States. Blacks fighting side by side with whites. The national struggle to liberate Haiti directly benefited the United States and other countries in the Western Hemisphere. In 1801, Bonaparte set out to conquer Haiti, France's wealthiest colony. Instead, Haiti defeated Napoleon's best troops. History records that in response to this defeat, Napoleon promptly sold his largest remaining colony in the New World to President Thomas Jefferson in what is known as the Louisiana Purchase. And finally, winning its independence in 1804, Haiti made sure that its liberty profited the struggle of General Bolivar in freeing Northern South America. This historic evidence of Haiti's contribution to raising the collective consciousness of the international community was recognized in 1949 when American President Harry Truman delivered a message to Haiti on the occasion of the bicentennial of our capital city, Port-au-Prince. He praised Haiti for steadfastly supporting the democracies during two world wars and for speaking on behalf of peace and concord among nations. Today, the struggle for justice, dignity, and peace by the people of Haiti again raises the collective consciousness of the international community. Our struggle in Haiti and the victory of our sisters and brothers in South Africa bring the world one step further in what Hegel calls the progress of the consciousness of freedom. South Africa proves to us all that events do shift with dramatic impact. Changes occur which, the moment before they happen, seem impossible. Who among us really believe that we would live to see an interracial democracy in South Africa? How could we imagine that a man imprisoned for 27 years could rise to be that nation's president? World events do move from the seemingly impossible to the possible. So too can they move in Haiti. In the 1930s and 40s, the problems of the Jewish refugees, too, seemed like an impossible situation to resolve. Their experience is not unlike our Haitian refugee experience. In May 1939, 900 Jews traveled on the St. Louis from one country to the next in search of refuge. At each port, they were turned away and never allowed to disembark. After some time, the boat was forced to return to the repressive regime from which it was fleeing. Let's say in Hebrew, Yom Yom Anachnu Medabrim al Abeyayot Shelanu, Vezekimat Otodavar, Anachnu Utsim Shalom Ba'aret Shelanu, Adakshav Ze Rameyod. Haitians to continue to meet this fate. Just last Monday, 29 refugees were returned to Haiti. They included two pregnant women and a baby. After their return to Haiti, most were detained by Haiti's military. Three are still in detention. On Thursday, another 61 were repatriated. Indeed, since May 8th, when it was announced that there would be a change in the policy towards our refugees, 1,957 people have been summarily returned to Haiti. What do the refugees face when they return to Haiti? Escalating violence and political repression, the UN Civilian Mission continues to report, adding to the already 5,000 murders since the September 1991 coup. In our move towards the restoration of democracy in Haiti, we must acknowledge that the refugee crisis will not end until democracy is restored to Haiti. Given the escalating violence and repression, it would be immoral to ask people whose very lives are at risk to stay in Haiti, a Haiti which I am compelled to describe as a house on fire. Democracy must be restored to Haiti. After the restoration of democracy, there will be reconciliation. This will lead us to the political stability that we established during our first 7 months in office. It will allow us to build a state of law, to build a nation where there is peace for all, respect for every single citizen, unity and justice among all of us. A Haiti that will embrace its refugees and end the massive migration of its citizens to the coast of Florida, as we had done for 7 months. This is reconciliation. This climate of respect and peace will lead to the political stability needed for the nation to progress. This is the new Haiti that we envision. This is the new Haiti that you and our brave journalists in Haiti will soon write off. This is the new Haiti that will be heir to democracy restored. Today, we stand on the eve of the 1 year anniversary of the Governor's Island Agreement. The issue is not whether this agreement can fulfill its mandate to restore democracy in Haiti. The issue is how long will it take? Despite this long 1 year interlude that has claimed many lives, including that of our Minister of Justice, we are certain that with the political will of the international community, it can. Democracy must be restored, not through military intervention, but through the implementation of the Governor's Island Agreement. This is not based on an illusion, nor is it based on fiction. In the past 6 weeks, new dynamics in Haiti, the enforcement of the embargo at the Dominican border, the suspension of financial transactions, the ban on commercial flights by some nations, not all, the freeze of the assets of those determined to be supporters of the coup, make the seemingly impossible look possible. But how much longer will this added suffering last? Months? No. Weeks? No. Robert F. Kennedy once said, "Justice delayed is democracy denied." Let us hope that the political will of the international community will force implementation of the Governor's Island Agreement so that the end to this horrible crisis in Haiti can come quickly. That means clearly, first, the departure of the coup leaders. Second, deployment of the United Nations Technical Assistance Mission in Haiti. Third, my prompt return to Haiti. And fourth, implementation of a program of reform contemplated by the agreement. Now let's move step by step to this program. First, military reform. Please don't try to understand the Haitian army in the light of your army. It consumes 40% of the national budget. From the year of our independence, 1804, to the year of 1957, when François Duvalier took office, among 36 Haitians head of state, 24 were overthrown by a coup. So this army involved in a tradition of coup is today involved in drug trafficking. Every year, it's a question of 46 to 48 tons of cocaine passing through Haiti to come here. And that brings $1.2 billion to them. This army has to be professionalized. Second, judicial reform. Our program for judicial reform will be financed by the $65 million allocated for institutional reform in Haiti. A reformed judiciary will ensure justice, instill confidence in the integrity of government, and offer constitutional avenue for recourse to equity. As we said, we repeat it today, and we will continue saying the same. No to vengeance, no to retaliation, no to impunity, yes to justice, yes to reconciliation. Wir antworten Gewalt, nicht mit Gewalt. Third, economic stability. We must respond to Haiti's ravaged economy by adopting a macroeconomy policy to immediately curb inflation, balance the budget, and control government spending. The international community has committed $228 million to assist us in this area. The gross national product declined by 10.8% during the 1991-92 fiscal year, and by another 4% in 1992-93. We must regain the confidence of the World Bank, which in 1991 commended our government for, quote, providing a window of opportunity for the country to finally move towards sustained social and economic progress, unquote. This can be achieved through proper management of government resources, including improved public administration of ministries and diligent enforcement of the tax code. The budget must be restructured. A nation devoting 40% of its budget to the military cannot prosper and will not grow. In 1991, we succeeded in balancing the budget and for the first time in many years, created a surplus. We saw an increase by 41 million good, approximately $5.8 million in the government's monthly revenues. This, again, must be our goal. Fourth, healthcare for all. I will not tell you that in Haiti, although on one side we have one soldier for each 1,000 Haitians, unfortunately, for each 10,000 Haitians, we still have 1.8 doctors. In a country where we say we have 56 hospitals, but unfortunately, we have just 1.5 hospital beds for each 1,000 Haitians. It's not fair. We have to have healthcare for all. Fifth, education for all. Also, I will tell you that only 10% of our schools are public. It's not fair in a country where we still have 85% illiteracy rate to continue maintaining the status quo without reducing this too high level of illiteracy rate. 85%, it's too much. One school ought to be built in each of our 565 districts. Six, reverse environmental deterioration. Haiti is moving dangerously close to an irreversible ecological disaster. Deforestation has accelerated, and soil erosion has grown worse. Since the onset of the political crisis, charcoal production has increased by 40%, which means that an additional 7,500 trees are cut down each month. In 1978, forests accounted for 7% of the land surface. By 1989, that number was reduced to 1.3%, a simple campaign to plant fruit trees, starting first with the near 200,000 acres of state-owned land, then extending to other lands, can alter this dangerous course. Seven, revitalize the agricultural sector. Due to severe deforestation and erosion, 20% of our topsoil has already washed away through the sea. Every year, we lose another 1%. Eight, revamp our communication system. So to bring Haiti into the century of global communication. Those of you who have traveled to Haiti as journalists know how bad our communication system is. We will have to change it. Ninth, institutional reform. We will reform and strengthen the nation's institutions, especially our parliament, and provide its members with the opportunity to work with the nation. As during our 7 months, members of parliament will work in safety. They will not be ruled by the gun, as they are now. They will not be forced to live in hiding, as they are today. And they will not be threatened, harassed, or killed, as they have been since the 1991 coup. And finally, encourage growth and development of an open market system. As we have done since the beginning of our term in office, we will promote growth in the private sector. We recognize the pressing need to revitalize the industrial sector and attract jobs to replace those lost as a result of the coup. The 75% unemployment rate cannot stand. The industrial sector, which is generally limited to Port-au-Prince, employs approximately 5.7% of the population, yet accounts for 15% of the GNP. New businesses and present businesses will be supported by major improvements in the country's infrastructure. This is what the nation can look forward to after the restoration of democracy. The restoration of democracy will bring peace for all, reconciliation among all, and for all a climate in which to prosper. As during this first 7 months of my mandate, we will continue moving from misery to poverty with dignity. And I would like to repeat, because it's very important for all of us as a people. We will continue to move from misery to poverty with dignity. An old proverb reads, "Give light, and the people will find their own way." Haiti needs the light of a free press, the light of our brave journalists, and those who work with them. We must change conditions where, for every 1,000 citizens, only 46 have radios, only 7 have access to daily newspapers, and only 5 have access to televisions. Be the satellites hovering outside of Haiti, ready to transmit the story of our struggle to raise the collective consciousness of the world on the challenges that we face, and ready to report on our success in restoring justice, peace, and reconciliation. Dear friends, with great joy, the world assembled in South Africa on May 10th to celebrate democracy. So too, will this happen in Haiti. We invite you there one day soon to witness this new beginning. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. President. We have a lot of questions here, of course, and many of them are like the first one here, so I will ask that one first. You have said that you would not oppose a military strike to oust the coup leaders. Yet on Saturday, you said you would never, never, never support a U.S. invasion. Please explain.
Sorry.
Thank you for your questions. On February 7, 1986, Jean-Claude Duvalier left Haiti without a military intervention. Years later, General Nafi left Haiti almost the same way. And after him, General Avril left Haiti almost after him the same way. We do believe that, as I said, we can restore democracy not through military intervention, but through the implementation of the Governors Island Agreement, which means clearly pressure, keeping pressure on the coup leaders in order to have them stepping aside. Jean-Claude Duvalier left, they also can leave.
But if the Coast Guard is soon to be overwhelmed with a new flood of refugees, how long do you think the Clinton administration can put off not having some kind of resolution to the problem in Haiti?
It's a real drama. It's a real tragedy. It's a real genocide. The more we wait before the restoration of democracy, unfortunately, the more we may see refugees leaving Haiti, fleeing political repression. You do believe that the Haitians love Haiti. They want to stay home. For instance, when I was in Haiti during 7 months, the Haitians were staying in Haiti. As I said, and allow me to say it again, we were moving from misery to poverty with dignity, and they were staying home. The international community understood what we were doing. That's why they said they would be giving $511 million to us. Before receiving this money, the Haitians were staying home. So that's why I think, and I say it again, let's speed this process of restoring democracy, because that's the only way we will solve this crisis. It will be good for Haiti as it will be good for the United States. It's not good for the President of the United States to see many refugees coming to the United States. It's not good for the President of Haiti to see the Haitians fleeing Haiti. Once we restore democracy, President Clinton and I, the American people and the Haitian people, together, we will celebrate because we will have the solution.
This questioner says, the New York Times reports today that an aide to Lieutenant General Cedrus, where he says Cedrus plans to retire in October. Do you lend any credence to such a report?
Yes, I do. It's an important question. Because General Cedrus said at Governor's Island, when we signed this agreement on July 12th, he would step aside to allow our return to Haiti on October 30th. And he did it. So he lies. He doesn't care when he has to lie. In the face of the world, he did that. Again, he's trying to do the same, because that means for themselves, one more day for the coup leaders and one less for us. It's a dilatory maneuver to waste time. When we have so many refugees coming to us, today we read it in the press, the New York Times said clearly, from Friday to today, 1,800 Haitians were intercepted. And for some people, more were trying to flee. How long do we have to wait before stopping this fleeing from repression? It's a house on fire. How could they stay in that house on fire? It's a big question. Fortunately, we have the solution, which is the restoration of democracy soon.
Is there any chance that General Cedrus and his colleagues can be paid to give up power and leave Haiti in exchange for amnesty?
I'm glad to have this wonderful opportunity to renew my commitment, not only to Haiti, but to the entire world. I say no to vengeance, no to retaliation, no to impunity, yes to justice, yes to reconciliation. That's why I already gave political amnesty to the coup leaders, because to save lives, I want them to be out. If some people want to pay them, that's their business. I want them to be out because that's the way we can save Haiti. That's the way we can have reconciliation for all of us, respect, justice, unity among all of us. So if there are some people in Haiti or here in the United States and in the international community who would like to help us speeding this process, they may do it the way they think they should be doing this. And regarding myself, I already gave political amnesty to them according to the Article 147 of our Constitution. I will be back to feed reconciliation among all of us in my country.
One of the charges against you is that while you were president, you were beginning to incite the lower classes against the ruling elite. What assures the ruling elite in Haiti that if you return, they will not be the target of violent reprisals?
Also an important question. It's a charge. And when you are a president, you have to be ready to listen to people criticizing you. Sometimes there is basis for those critics, and some other time, no. For instance, for this one, no. We need a political stability in Haiti. Without this political stability, there is no way to create a climate in which we can prosper. In Haiti, although our army of 7,000 officers and soldiers control 40% of the national budget, and moving from one coup to another one, let's say it again, we are the first black independent country in the world. We got our independence in 1804, and from that year to 1957, we had 36 Haitian head of states, and 24 were overthrown by a coup. That means in this country where less than 1% can have more than 45% of the national revenue, you have a situation of using this army to keep the status quo moving from one coup to another one. How did I do? How do I want to do it again? On February 7, 1991, the day of my inauguration, I said, no more blood, not even one drop of blood in our country. We celebrated a marriage between the Haitian army and the Haitian people because we wanted to move with this climate of unity. We had that 7 months of political stability, which is indispensable for the elite to go up with business. And we will creating this climate of political stability to have the elite investing, because we want them and they have the right to stay home, to work, to invest. And as the president of every single citizen, I have to protect the rights of the elite as I have the obligation to protect the rights of the employers. Those who will be investing, the elite and you, businesses, you will be welcome. Those who will find jobs also, they will find the same climate of security, of political stability. I can promise it again, the elite will find their president working with them to create jobs for those who need jobs, and the president will be respecting again their rights and the rights of every single citizen.
This questioner asks, tomorrow, if General Cedrus agreed to step down, only if you simultaneously, too, would also step down in order to put in place a coalition, temporary government, which would lead to a presidential election in the scheduled fall, in the fall of 94, would you mutually agree to step aside in order to end the embargo and suffering of your people and restore order and economy and avoid invasion?
I distinguish two aspects in this question. The first one, maybe many people don't know what did I do in terms of building unity in the country. In our first government, we had people from the bourgeoisie. To have the second one, I was the one deciding to choose one of the wealthiest family in Haiti to become our prime minister. I wanted to do that, and I did. I had to face opposition because many people didn't want me to bring someone who looked like a white person from a wealthy family to become the prime minister. They didn't want. But I do, because I wanted to create a bridge, a social bridge between rich and poor in the country, and I did. That's the way we have to do it to save the nation, rich and poor working together. In the same government, they already resigned, the prime minister and the other ministers, but in this same government, we have other ministers from the bourgeoisie. For instance, the Minister of Finance, she's from the bourgeoisie. Our former Minister of Commerce, he's from the bourgeoisie, and I could move on. Two other ministers are from the army. The Minister of Defense is a general. The Minister of Interior is a colonel. Four other ministers are from four political parties. All that to not talk about unity without giving the proof, without proving that we can do it, and we did. Again, we will continue moving this same way to build unity, reconciliation, reforming our judicial system to save the nation. Second aspect, someone in Haiti said in a public meeting, or quite a public meeting, I am giving jobs to hundreds of Haitians. They went to vote on December 16, 1990. I also went to vote. How could you imagine that I would accept that their votes can be equal to my vote, he said. And they said to him, well, it's an apartheid reality if you talk that way. And he answered, of course. That's the reality. We had our first free and fair democratic election on December 16, 1990, where 67% of the population voted for me. 33 months later, they still continue fighting peacefully to have me back. That means after testing democracy during 7 months, they know what they did by choosing their president. They know why they can continue to suffer under the weight of this embargo, because they want to have democracy back in the country. Now it's not only those 67% who voted for me. It's more than that. I would say clearly, close or more to 90% of the population are waiting for my return. That's why if I respect the result of those elections, if I respect my people, I have to continue saying yes to the mandate of 5 years. So it's not a question of doing what I want, it's a question of doing what they want me to do due to our first fair and free elections.
How do you explain former President Bush's change of position on your return to Haiti?
I respect former President Bush. I have to respect every single citizen in the world. That's my way to be. As a president, I have to listen to people. When I realize they are right, I have to thank them because they can help me changing my position when they are right. But also when I realize they are wrong, I have to be honest to say, no, it's not fair, it's wrong. If you want to hide your body you cannot use one finger to hide that. With something which is not true, you cannot hide a policy which is false regarding our refugees. So I think the best way to continue moving is to listen to people who may disagree. This is democracy. In that case, I disagree, and I continue sharing respect with former President Bush and with every single citizen in the entire world.
There are several questions along this line. The State Department has asked you for some time to give an accounting of the finances of your government. So far, you have not complied. When will you give this accounting, and how do you explain the millions of dollars paid for public relations and lobbyists? And what about the $2.5 million in checks you have received from the ambassador from Taiwan?
I was talking about criticism having basis or there no. For those, there is no basis. Our lawyers, I have the pleasure to see some of them here, are working to prepare a clear answer for those who want to know about why we are spending money here through lobbyists and what. In Haiti, we have a situation where thugs, after killing over 5,000 people, continue to spend money, sometimes they just plunder the national treasury to get that. Sometimes they just take it from the drug trafficking, which brings $1.2 billion to them every year. And part of this money, they spend it here in Washington through allies or lobbyists in order to keep the status quo in Haiti. So they are using this money against the nation. As the duly elected president of the nation, I have the obligation to spend some money, to have lawyers defending the nation because they have lobbies lying for them to defend the coup. So it's an obligation. When the day will come, as usual, we will use transparency, and we have to explain the nation why and what. Why we spent money, what did we spend?
What is your message to the refugees fleeing Haiti today? Should they stay or leave?
I just had a wonderful meeting with Reverend Bill Gray. Together we work, and I'm very glad to work with him. I think President Clinton did a good move by choosing him. And with him, we will continue working in a very good relationship to restore that democracy. With him, we are working on a program to broadcast to Haiti. That may start soon. Obviously, because everybody can recognize that Haiti looks like a house on fire. We cannot ask people to stay in this house on fire. Do we have to ask them to leave? No. Because when they leave, they may die. That's why if I cannot ask them to stay in this house on fire, if I cannot ask them to leave, I have to continue doing my best working with the president and his special advisor, Mr. Bill Gray, the administration, and the international community to see how we can speed this process, because only through this process we will have the solution, which is the restoration of democracy. Last year, I joined President Clinton asking them to stay in Haiti, promising the restoration of democracy. I did, because I thought we would have that restoration of democracy soon. More than 1 year later, and by the time we are losing Haitians, maybe right now we are talking about them and some of them are dying. I do have the responsibility to protect lives. And by protecting lives, I cannot ask them to stay because they may kill them there. I cannot ask them to leave because they may die somewhere else. I am doing my best with President Clinton, with the international community, to see how we could restore democracy soon, and that way the refugees will be so happy to celebrate peace restored, democracy restored in their country.
Do you categorically say that the United States should not intervene in Haiti militarily, and what will be your response if it does?
In the National Press Club, it's good to have tough questions like this one. I don't want to waste time, but before answering this question, let me share a joke with you, a very wonderful joke. I met a journalist one day in Paris, and he came from Haiti, where he wanted to know how the poor people saw the embargo months ago. And he was in Cité Soleil, where he asked a lady, and that lady was pregnant, how do you see the embargo? And the lady told him, you see me? I am pregnant. When I will have my baby, I will name him Embargo. That was her way to answer. It was easy for her to get her answer. Is it so easy for me to get my answer regarding this question? I don't know, but I try. We have to do our best to have the coup leaders out of Haiti. If I ask for military intervention, I will be impeached by my constitution. It would be a gift for the coup leaders. I cannot. I don't have to. If United States thinks they have to threaten the coup leaders based on their experience, they may choose the best way to help us restoring democracy, having the removal of the coup leaders. I am doing my best, they have doing their best, and each one can complete each other, knowing clearly that once I would call for military intervention, I would be impeached by my constitution, which would be a gift for the coup leaders and as bad for me as it would be for United States.
That is complicated. Do you expect Bill Gray to recommend to President Clinton tighter sanctions or a complete embargo? And if so, when do you think he will?
Yes, the Haitian people, because we are proud of being sons and daughters of our forefathers, always fighting for freedom, always fighting for peace, always through a non-violent way, trying to see how we can restore Haiti, we accepted to suffer under the weight of those sanctions, as it is for today, hoping soon we will have the result, which has to be the restoration of democracy. But at the same time, we ask, how long will the Haitian people will see this restoration of democracy? How long do we have to wait? How long do we have to suffer? I think once the international community expresses the political will, which is indispensable to speed the process, the coup leaders will do something on their side to step aside. And it's still possible. United as nations in the world to speed this process and to have the coup leaders realizing now it's not the same joke, it's over. They cannot stay anymore trying to waste time. So I encourage the international community to speed the process, and regarding myself, I will be doing the same.
Do you think the U.S. policy of stopping Haitian refugees and allowing Cuban refugees to enter this country is racist?
You may remember when sometimes there are Cubans and Haitians fleeing. The policy is different regarding Haitians and the Cubans. One day on CNN, I saw a boat coming with Haitians and Cubans as refugees. They welcomed the Cubans and they sent the Haitians back to Haiti, to this house on fire. I'm glad when they welcome the Cubans because they are my brothers. And mis hermanos y hermanas de Cuba saben que todos nosotros tenemos que seguir luchando para que haya paz, democracia, reconciliación, justicia en nuestra tierra. Así no es necesario decir que puedo compartir lo que es dolor tanto en nuestro país como en otros países. I understand it's necessary to have peace everywhere, yes. But also I cannot say it's not racist if we welcome some and we send the others back. The policy can be changed to not project this image. That's why I don't want to put the focus on the aspect of critics, but more on the positive side, what we can do. And it's possible to change it, it's possible to make it better. Overall, from today, I do believe it could be a question of days before having this restoration of democracy. Once together, we move to celebrate in Haiti what we celebrated in South Africa on May 10th.
We are about out of time. Before asking the last question, I'd like to present you with a certificate of appreciation for appearing here and a National Press Club mug, which now you now have two of them, and you can use them to toast your return.
Thank you.
And the last question is, this questioner, or this person, oops, says that he's with the Comfort, which is the Navy hospital ship helping your people. What would you say to our medical people helping your people?
Thank you. A couple of weeks ago, I had the opportunity to meet in New York over 200 Haitian doctors, nurses, and together we were trying to see how we could work to prepare the program for healthcare. I remind you that in Haiti, for each 10,000 citizens, we have just 1.8 doctors. So we have more Haitians as doctors, more Haitian doctors living out of Haiti than living in the country. But those living out of the country, together we are working. We are doing almost the same with the Haitian professors, with the Haitian engineers, trying to see how being back will continue saving the nation, building a state of law where rich, poor professionals, people who went to school, those who have to go to school, together we can work. What I will say to the doctors, first of all, thanks on behalf of the Haitian people for what you provide as health care to our citizens. Second, hope, yes, we have to share that hope, because we hope one day we will not have 1.8 doctors for each 10,000 Haitians, because we will have a new program for healthcare, creating a political stability. We will welcome not only those who are now working with us, but also others who would like to come to Haiti, to live in Haiti, to help us rebuilding this nation. So thanks to you on behalf of the Haitian people, and hope one day you will feel good in that country where we used to smile, not because we are not living in misery, but because we believe in ourselves. And also we believe in friends who are truly friends, because with cooperation with you, we will continue smiling to the future. The future belongs to us. We can change it, and which can today looks like impossible will become possible. Once again, I would like to extend on behalf of the Haitian people a special thank you to the National Press Club, to you, our distinguished friends, wishing one day we will not be here, Last year I was here, this year I'm here, and next year in Haiti. Thank you.
Listening to the Internet Town Hall, a production of the Internet Multicasting Service in association with the National Press Club. You may copy this file and change the encoding format, but may not resell the contents or make a derivative work. Support for the Internet Town Hall comes from Sun Microsystems and O'Reilly & Associates. Additional support is provided by HarperCollins and Persoft. Network connectivity is provided by UUNET Technologies and MFS DataNet. This is Carl Malamud for the Internet Multicasting Service, Town Crier to the Global Village.